G'day and welcome to Between the Lines. I'm Tom Switzer. This week, a chat with Niall Ferguson, eminent historian, prolific author, provocative columnist, and creator of highly successful television documentaries. He's also the official biographer of Henry Kissinger, the former US Secretary of State, who met with, of all people, Donald Trump this week. Niall Ferguson, he's in Sydney this week as a guest of the Centre for Independent Studies, the leading classical liberal think tank. Stay with us for the Scots-born and Oxford-educated Harvard professor. We'll talk terror, US foreign policy, the global economy, the populist backlash, and Kissinger himself. Niall Ferguson on this week's edition of Between the Lines. G'day, Niall. Welcome back to Australia.
Great to be back.
Now, within days of 9/11, you wrote in The Independent, quote, "This is the moment when the US can and should take decisive action against those rogue regimes which have for too long harboured or financed terrorism." And you went on to argue, top of the hit list must be Saddam Hussein, followed by the Taliban government in Afghanistan. I should be sorry if Colonel Gaddafi were to escape unscathed. Now, that was you in the London Independent just after 9/11. Second thoughts?
3 out of 3. I mean, I said decisive action. Notice I didn't say invasion and occupation. I think it would have been very strange if the United States had taken no decisive action against the Taliban, so I don't have a second thought about that. I think on the issue of Iraq, we could spend the rest of the interview debating whether or not it was the right thing to do. It seemed to a great many people like the right thing to do until after things began to go wrong. My position at the time was that the United States was biting off more than it could chew. I wrote a book around about the time of the invasion called Colossus, The Rise and Fall of America's Empire. My argument there was that the United States was getting into the empire business by essentially occupying and trying to transform Iraq into a US-style democracy, and it probably wouldn't succeed at this because of its various deficits, not least its attention deficit disorder. So I think I was right about that. So the decisive action that was taken, I thought, was overreach. I argued that the United Kingdom should stay out of that operation, by the way. And as for Gaddafi, well, Gaddafi really had been a sponsor of terrorism. In the period after 9/11, Gaddafi cleaned up his act under considerable external pressure. And it wasn't really our actions that got rid of him. It was the Arab Spring. It was a revolution from within the Arab world. But we helped it on. And I think one of the things that we should really ask some hard questions about is whether it was right to assist with the deposition or attempt to assist with the deposition of rulers, tyrants, dictators, whatever you want to call them in the Arab world, without really following through in any meaningful way to ensure the stability of the states that we were intervening in. And if you look at Libya today, it's in a state of chaos. You look at Syria, it's even worse. And you look back, and I think you conclude, and I certainly would say this without many reservations, that we tried two different approaches, or at least the US tried two different approaches after 9/11. One was massive intervention and quasi-imperial policies, and the other was a sort of hesitant, half-assed non-intervention. And it's hard to know which of these two things has been worse.
In hindsight, do you think that the policy of containment and deterrence, the no-fly zone, the sanctions regime, the naval blockade, just the principles of deterrence, could that have kept Saddam Hussein in the box? Because some foreign policy realists were making this argument. But in the heat of the post-9/11 era, they were drowned out by the more hawkish, alarmist voices about Saddam.
With hindsight, yes. It seems to me that one of the things I got wrong, and I was in pretty good company in 2002 in the run-up to the Iraq invasion, was failing to see that the principal beneficiary would in fact be Iran. And when you think about it, that's staringly obvious, and it's absolutely classic balance of power theory, but hardly anybody made that point. I've been doing some research on this because we can now at least begin to do the history properly. What's fascinating about the decision-making process immediately after 9/11 was how quickly elements within the Bush administration, Rumsfeld, Cheney and others, sought to put Iraq near the top of the agenda. And they'd been looking for a pretext to act in Iraq, and 9/11 provided it. I think one of the great failures of the national security operation in the Bush administration was to push back against that. Nobody, as far as I can see, unless they did it in documents that simply haven't been released, nobody said, look, we really shouldn't do this because the beneficiary will be Iran.
Well, indeed, because if you do create a democracy in an arbitrarily created state and an ethnically and tribally divided society like Iraq, and remember it's the Sunni who have been the minority rulers there for so long and the majority Shia have been repressed, it would make sense that the Shia would be the dominant forces. And what have we seen since? We've seen the Shia sectarian regime in Baghdad more interested in seeking revenge against their former Sunni tormentors than in building a nation.
And what wasn't at all surprising was the insurgency that followed very shortly after the US invasion. I remember realizing early on that virtually none of the key decision makers knew the first thing about the history of Iraq. I was getting emails from young officers in the field saying, could you tell us about this 1920 insurgency that the British had to deal with? And I was saying, yeah, kind of not too surprising that you're facing the same problem. The trouble is there are way more of them now, and they have way more powerful weapons. And so in some measure, history repeated itself. When the British set up Iraq, almost immediately they found that they had an insurgency on their hands. And, you know, there are two kinds of judgment we make in these sorts of cases. There's the with hindsight version that is based on the information that comes out later, and then there's the judgment that you make at the time on the basis of the information you have. I think on both counts, it was right to be skeptical about the notion of full-blown regime change and occupation. But I think today I see new reasons why I was right to be skeptical.
Well, on that note, I mean, you did say, though, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 about toppling the Iraqi and Libyan and Taliban regimes. Is this realistic? You said, sure, the US is, after all, the world hegemon. Whether Americans like it or not, they are an imperial power. Now, you weren't alone. This is what the senior Bush advisor, Karl Rove, said shortly before the US-led invasion in Iraq. Quote, America is an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality. Well, that reality looks like the mess in Batavia, Neil.
Yeah, the difference between me and Karl Rove, if it was indeed Karl Rove who said those famous words, is that I was going on to say, but look, you're not really going to make a great job of this because you have three problems. One is that you don't really have a large number of people who want to go and live in hot, dangerous places, unlike the British 100 or 200 years ago. Two, you already have a significant fiscal deficit, and this won't be cheap. I was very right about how expensive it was going to be, and the administration was very wrong. And three, you have an attention deficit disorder, which means that after a very short period of time, the American public will lose interest in this because it will be way harder than you expect, and it will take way longer than you expect. So that was the argument that I made then, and this then became the book Colossus, published in 2004. And I look back at that book recently, and I think its arguments stand up pretty well to the test of time. It's really played out much as anticipated. The backlash set in just after Bush secured re-election. I mean, it was a close-run thing because the public was already on the turn in 2004. But, you know, in the aftermath of that election, the mood soured. And we'd seen exactly this happen over Vietnam, and to some degree it had happened over Korea.
And Neil, could that explain why Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders have done so well? Because although they express themselves in different ways, they are railing against the notion that America should be the global policeman, that America's interventions in the Middle East all too often make a bad situation worse.
Oh, unquestionably. Part of the Trump phenomenon and the Sanders phenomenon is a backlash against the interventionism of the Bush administration, which to some degree Barack Obama ended up having to continue against all his instincts. Obama's instinct was to wrap up Iraq as fast as possible. That was a mistake because Iraq immediately plunged back into near anarchy. But he still had to do a surge in Afghanistan. He tried to stay out of Syria, and yet he's ended up having to intervene there too. So the public still feels that it is unnecessarily entangled in incredibly complex situations where there's really no good outcome likely. That's part of it, but I would say it's only part of it, Tom, because I don't think this election is mainly about foreign policy. I think that's a kind of add-on. And sure, you know, Trump is very gifted at rewriting his own history and portraying himself himself, you know, as a staunch skeptic, which I don't think he was. But, you know, people certainly are open to this message. You won't find many people ready to go up there and defend US policy in 2003. I mean, that is actually a fast track to oblivion in American politics today.
As Jeb Bush found out. Now, are you confident the US-led air campaign to defeat these Islamic State jihadists in Iraq and Syria, are you confident that will work?
No, it won't work.
Why?
Because it's impossible to defeat a terrorist network from the air in that way. And because Islamic State is a network and to a large extent lacks a central leadership, any attempt to decapitate it by taking out its leadership, which is really Obama's strategy, is bound to fail. Indeed, Obama's reluctance to commit ground troops, which I think is the only way you're going to be able to destroy Islamic State, ensures that it continues. And as long as it lasts, its credibility grows and the network grows. I think Islamic State's not really about the territory that it controls, the physical land that it controls, though it still controls a fairly large chunk of Syria. It's much more about the credibility that it can enjoy in the realm of social networks. And as long as Islamic State looks like it's holding its own against the mighty superpowers, not to mention the Russians, then it can make a very credible claim that it is the true sharp edge of Sunni Islam. And I'm afraid the longer we leave it, the more dangerous it becomes, not only in the Middle East and North Africa, but all over the world.
If you've just tuned in, you're with me, Tom Switzer, chatting with the prominent Harvard academic Neil Ferguson, who's in Sydney this week as a guest of the Center for Independent Studies. Neil, we're talking about the Islamic State. I've had several guests on this program over the last 18 months, and there seems to be a consensus that the campaign to destroy the Islamic State, it's a very noble, well-intended impulse, but it may well reaffirm that potent Sunni narrative, particularly in Iraq and in Syria, that we in the West are in cahoot with the sectarian Shia regimes aided and abetted by the mullahs in Tehran.
Well, of course. I mean, that's, I think, almost inevitable, given the way that the Obama administration's foreign policy has tilted towards Iran on the nuclear issue, amongst other things. The problem is that there is no kind of perfect motherhood and apple pie option available here. It's a choice between evils. And I think it is a greater evil to allow Islamic State to continue to function and to continue to make its claim that it is a state, that it is going to reestablish the caliphate. Why do I think that? Because ultimately, the trouble about Islamic State is that right now they look like a kind of ragtag army of crazy people who only control a few scraps of territory, most of it fairly worthless. But if they ended up in control of, let us say, Saudi Arabia, if they ended up with the holy sites plus the oil, then suddenly they would be in, as it were, the same situation the Bolsheviks were in. They would suddenly control some real power.
Let's move on to Russia. You wrote in your regular column in the Sunday Times, quote, "If there is one sure sign that a Trump presidency would be a disaster, it's the eagerness with which Putin looks forward to it." Neil, what's wrong with a US rapprochement with Moscow?
Well, I have a view of the Putin presidency, which I think is essentially that it has a combination of the old Soviet system, the mafia in its heyday, and what the Marxists used to call state monopoly capitalism. It's a very ugly beast. It's illiberal. It's populist to the verge of fascism. It has no interest in the stability of the Middle East because the Russian state is a petrostate or a gas state. It requires oil at $100 a barrel to function and keep the revenues flowing to the oligarchs and Mr. Putin himself. So any Russian initiative has to be viewed with great suspicion because they don't want to stabilize the Middle East.
But doesn't the United States have an interest with the Russians in defeating the Islamic State?
Well, I don't think that that would necessarily be item number one on Mr. Putin's agenda. Remember, when Putin proposed a deal back in September and Obama told him to go away, the first thing that Putin did was to unleash airstrikes, not against Islamic State, but against all the other anti-Assad forces that the Americans had been trying to back. And nobody should make the mistake of thinking that the Russians were attacking Islamic State. They were not. Indeed, Islamic State in some measure benefited from the Russian intervention.
Palmyra was liberated by the Russians, wasn't it?
Palmyra was a great propaganda opportunity for the Russians. But if you look carefully at the targets that they attacked, and you talk to anybody in Syria on the ground, they will tell you the Russians caused mayhem time in some of the anti-Assad areas that had become relatively stable. So I have no patience with the argument that the Russians were doing anything good. They have not got good intentions in that region.
But if they didn't prop up the Assad regime, wasn't there a danger that this Alawi regime could crumble and be taken over by the jihadists?
Well, I mean, it has largely crumbled. The country has crumbled into three, if not four, pieces. But I think you have to be very wary of thinking that the Russians are full of good intentions at this point. I think the most that they want is to retain some rump part of Syria, plus their naval base and air bases that Assad will be able to control. But remember, there's another thing on their agenda. That's Ukraine, and not only Ukraine, but also the whole of Eastern and Central Europe. And what makes me nervous about Trump, to put it mildly, is that Trump not only said he wants to do a great deal with Putin, quote unquote, but also that he's willing to regard NATO as essentially a vestigial organization. The whole security of Central Europe, I think, would be in the balance if Trump flew to Moscow and did the kind of deal that Putin wants to do.
Is Ukraine a vital US national interest?
No, but the stability of the Baltic states, of Poland, potentially also of other Central European countries, is a vital US interest because these countries are part of NATO and they are part of the Western system of defense. Ukraine probably was never going to be a great place for the United States to pick a fight with Russia, which is why Obama went down the route of sanctions. Yeah. But I think if we concede, and we're very close to doing that, that the annexation of Crimea was legitimate, which it wasn't, it was grotesquely illegal, and if we allow the Russians to keep any more of eastern Ukraine, which I think might well be part of the deal that Mr. Trump would do, then I think we send an incredibly negative signal to the countries that are members of NATO and who are watching with great alarm. There was a wonderful mural, I don't know if you saw it the other day, in one of the Baltic states, of Trump kissing Putin.
Yes, I saw that.
I thought that was a very prescient image.
On that note, now, Trump has met with Henry Kissinger, the subject of your two-volume biography. He met with him this week. Now, the former US Secretary of State has made the case for making a neutral Ukraine a buffer state between East and West, which would not threaten Russia. That's the kind of policy proposal you can imagine a President Trump likely to promote to Putin. Why is that so dangerous?
Well, we don't obviously know what Henry Kissinger and Donald Trump discussed. It's certainly not unusual for Kissinger to meet with prospective candidates for the presidency. In fact, I think it's more or less routine, and I wouldn't be at all surprised to hear that Hillary Clinton is meeting with him too. I think there's a big difference here between establishing Ukraine as, in geopolitical terms, a neutral state, that is to say, precluding any potential membership of NATO, which I would be fine with, and allowing it to be carved up, which I think is what Putin is aiming at. Mm-hmm. And so that's really the clear distinction. Trouble is, Donald Trump's a real estate guy. You know, I don't think he's going to really think twice about saying goodbye to not only Crimea, but Donetsk, because I think that's what Putin will ask for, and I think it's what he'll get.
Now, you're at the Sydney Opera House on Sunday evening addressing a Centre for Independent Studies event on financial crises, the lessons of history. Neil, how do you account for the rise of these populist and nationalist movements that are proliferating all over Europe at the moment?
Applied history is about trying to learn from the past, applying it to the present, and that's really what I do. After any major financial crisis, there's a lag and then there's a populist backlash. This was not only true after 1929, it was true after 1873. You name the crisis, I can show you the populist backlash. So it was really predictable that after a shock as big as 2008-2009, there would be populism all over the shop. And sure enough, it's there. And Trump, and one might also say Sanders, illustrate something that is generally happening right across the democracies of the Northern Hemisphere. And I stress the Northern Hemisphere to make a point. It's not really happening here. And it's very much over in South America. Populism is on the way out in places like Brazil, Venezuela, Argentina. It's gone in Argentina. But in the Northern Hemisphere, post the financial crisis, people are very attracted by demagogues offering solutions that are broadly xenophobic and are certainly anti-finance, anti-free market. And the great thing about populism is that it comes in two flavors. You can have populism of the right or the populism of the left. And the Americans currently have both. They can choose Trump or Sanders. And essentially, they're getting two flavors of the same argument. It's a very potent argument because it sounds plausible. If you are, let's say, Mr. Middle America, you're white, you don't have a college degree, you've probably never even been to New York, and you feel correctly, that you're worse off than you were 16 years ago. And you certainly don't think it's just because of foreign policy. And when you hear Donald Trump say, you know, your problems are due to Mexico, immigration, globalization, the Chinese, in other words, Muslims, then you're very receptive to that message. And I think that's what all the people in the political establishment, the commentariat, the people who write columns for a living on this subject, they all missed this because they underestimated the power of populism after a financial crisis.
And meanwhile, several academic economists say that the global financial crisis that's provoked this populism today, that's discredited Milton Friedman's liberal worldview. Now, of course, this year's a significant year for free marketeers because it's the 40th anniversary of the Nobel Prize winning economics laureate. And, of course, it's 10 years since Milton Friedman died. What do you make of that argument that the financial crisis has somehow discredited Milton Friedman?
It's wrong. It's very wrong, actually. Back at the time of the crisis, I argued that you would be able to predict what Ben Bernanke did as Fed chair, but by just looking at what Friedman and Schwartz described the Fed doing in the Great Depression,
that's
in
right.
their famous Monetary History of the United States, he would do the opposite. Because Friedman and Schwartz argued that the Depression became a depression because the Fed got it wrong and it tightened policy when it should have eased. And I think what Bernanke did was far more influenced by Friedman's view than it was by, say, the theories of John Maynard Keynes. So I think it's quite wrong to see this as in some measure discrediting Friedman. I think Friedman has been one of the key sources of inspiration for monetary policy. The only thing one can say is that Bernanke's probably gone further even than Friedman would have anticipated in unconventional monetary policy. He's gone beyond zero interest rates. He's gone into quantitative easing. And Friedman, I think, were he still here, would be going, wow, I didn't think it would need that much to avoid deflation. But the basic theoretical framework, the monetarist framework, I think, has been used to very good effect by Bernanke.
Yeah, and you could, of course, let's not forget the alternatives to capitalism that have been tried have always wound up a lot worse. My guest is the distinguished Scots-born Harvard academic Neil Ferguson. He's the author of the Kissinger biographies. Now, as it happens, Kissinger turns 93 next week, Neil. He's going strong. Crikey.
He is.
Do you keep in regular touch with him?
Well, I'm writing his biography, so I need to, and I'm only halfway through it. I've published volume one, and I still have the mountain of volume two to climb, which covers the period from 1969 to now. So, yeah, we are in regular touch, and I shall see him at some point after I return to the
United States. Because your first volume
took
place over a decade, and the second volume that you just mentioned will come out, 3 years, 4 years?
I think it's 3 or 4 years. Yeah. I've got quite a lot of the research done, but there's still a bunch of difficult archives to get into, like the Chinese archives, which
are
very inaccessible.
Indeed. Well, we mentioned earlier that Trump met with Kissinger this week. One other admirer of Kissinger is Hillary Clinton, but not everyone likes your subject. Here's Bernie Sanders during a primary debate with Clinton earlier this year.
Where the secretary and I have a very profound difference. In the last debate, and I believe in her book, very good book, by the way, in her book and in this last debate, she talked about getting the approval or the support or the mentoring of Henry Kissinger. Now, I find it rather amazing because I happen to believe that Henry Kissinger was one of the most destructive secretaries of state in the modern history of this country. I am proud to say that Henry Kissinger is not my friend. I will not take advice from Henry Kissinger. And in fact, Kissinger's actions in Cambodia, when the United States bombed that country, overthrew Prince Sihanouk, created the instability for Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge to come in, who then butchered some 3 million innocent people, one of the worst genocides in the history of the world. So count me in as somebody who will not be listening to Henry Kissinger.
Well, I know journalists have asked who you do listen to on foreign policy, and we have yet to know who that is.
Well, it ain't Henry Kissinger.
That's fine.
Who would have thought that Henry Kissinger would be such a lively subject in a presidential primary debate? Neil Ferguson.
Well, wonderful from the point of view of his biographer. I don't really, don't really need to answer the question, why did you write a biography of Henry Kissinger anymore? Because it's obvious, because if Trump is seeing Kissinger and Hillary is consulting Kissinger and Sanders is denouncing Kissinger, he may be nearly 93, but he's still clearly a major issue in U.S. political life. And, you know, it was fascinating to hear that exchange. I'm sure Bernie Sanders' young followers and his supporters are very youthful, must have been wondering what he was on about, because I guess most of them haven't read the books he'd obviously read, Christopher Hitchens's Trial of Henry Kissinger, and I think he might even have dipped into Willie Shawcross's book on the Cambodia saga. It's a fascinating reflection of how alive the 1970s still are for that generation of political actors, that that could come up in a debate for the nomination for the Democratic Party presidential candidate. I mean, it's why I wanted to write the book, to be honest. I think a man who was a hero in the time when he was in office, because he was super K in 1973, is now regarded by the likes of Bernie Sanders as a war criminal responsible for genocide. You can't really ask for a more interesting subject for a biography.
Is Kissingerian realism still relevant in today's world with the rise of these jihadists, globalization, transnationalism?
Sure, although I make the point in Volume 1 that he wasn't really a realist. The subtitle of Volume 1 is The Idealist, and I tried to show that Kissinger, in the context of the Cold War, and even when he talks about the 1930s, when he was a refugee himself from Nazi Germany, Kissinger was not, strictly speaking, a realist. A realist meaning, just in case your listeners are wondering, somebody who narrowly defines foreign policy as being about national interest and has no real interest in anything beyond that. And Kissinger was much more an idealist in the Cold War. He argued that the Cold War was fundamentally a struggle between ideas of freedom and unfreedom. It wasn't even just about economics. He was very against a sort of materialistic view that it was just a struggle between two economic systems. And I think if you look at his most recent work, he's been very open to the argument that Islamic extremism represents a real revolutionary challenge to our ideas of freedom. So I think it's more the idealist that's in play here than the realist, though I think in some ways these are not mutually exclusive positions.
Contrarian take. Neil, it's been a pleasure to see you. Thanks so much for being on ABC Radio today.
Thank you, Tom.
That was Neil Ferguson from Harvard University, who's in Sydney this week as a guest of the Centre for Independent Studies.